we started last week, and just my last approach that you can use. And I hope I can do this one justice, this solution-focused intervention. It's actually my favourite approach, and if you get a chance in any of your early training or your extra work to do any courses through the Brief Therapy Institute in Parramatta, or anything, it's got a couple of names. It's called Solution Focused Intervention. It's also called Brief Family Therapy, even though it's not really, you know, a therapy in a classic sense. But it's also called Strength-Based Counselling or Strength-Based Approaches for Schools. And the reason I like it is it's really practical. It's quite creative. It's a bit out there. Anything goes, as long as you know what you're doing. So understanding the principles. So hopefully, if I don't get a chance to really explain some of the techniques or demonstrate them in the time we've got this morning, I hope you get a chance to find out a little bit more about it. And otherwise. There's some links on the website that I've put there that will give you a bit more understanding. And some of the slides that go through a number of different questions to ask and stuff like that, they're actually in worksheet form on the web. So you can just download them as PDFs and have them as a reference. So that's a lot easier to use than the slides. So I'm going to try to stop at about 25 past, have a quick break, and then in the second set, the last session, do what I think is the most relevant for you guys, and that is looking at technology in the classroom, in schools, how it can really engage those kids that you just can't, don't seem interested in any other ways. And it's the most underused resource that we use in schools at the moment. You've been out to schools, you've seen that most schools have whiteboards and projectors somewhere in the school, and I ask you how many times did you see them being used as a whiteboard, not just as a means of showing something on the data projector, that they were really being used interactively. And I'll show you some resources and talk to you about what you need to build into your interactive resources to get kids who won't do it work in any other way totally engaged in doing the work. And it's like you see another side of some kids once they're using the technology. So we'll look at that. So let's start with this. I think I gave you this question. This is just trying to get your head around the principles of solution focused. It's this idea that sometimes we grab hold of something and we just stick to it. And no matter what, if it doesn't work, we still just do it more. I mean, a classic example, suspension from school. We know suspension doesn't seem to have much effect on kids, but we just keep suspending them. Some kids get suspended 5, 6, 7 times. Nothing works. They just keep going through the cycle. It's got to work. Something's got to happen next time. It's like a wing in a prayer, or hope and pray that next time it's going to work, even though it didn't work the last 5 times. So we tend to do this. So it's this whole idea of looking at other possibilities. How we look at things. How do we go a little bit outside the box for the sake of trying to find something that's going to work? And how do we go outside the box? We're not out just flying off into the ether, but actually going somewhere where we know what we're doing when we're outside that box. And that's what we're looking at in this this approach. So you had a big night, some of you, so I'm not going to ask you to read that. I just put that up as a reference for you. I'll just tell you this story. It starts the book by Michael Durant, who's the local expert on solution focused, who does the training in Parramatta. And a group of 14-year-old boys are out in the playground. They decide to have a bit of a game. They're going to pretend they got a tennis ball, I think it was a tennis ball, and they start bouncing the ball around and throwing it to each other, doing all sorts of tricks that you can only do with an imaginary tennis ball. And they're having a great time. So they decide to take this into their classroom. So they walk into one classroom and they start throwing them around the classroom. And the teacher says, right, give me the ball, guys. So they sort of throw the imaginary ball to the teacher. The teacher says, thanks very much, sticks it in the drawer. Nothing else heard of it. No other issue. Then they walk into another teacher's classroom and they start throwing the ball around. The teacher sort of ducks a couple of times and the kids just settle down and go on with their lesson. They walk into a third classroom trying to do the same thing. The teacher says, put the ball away. So they, you know, they're playing a bit of a game with it. He says, oh, I've told you to put the ball away. You can't, you know, stop doing that. And they end up getting sent to the deputy. And the deputy says, oh, you know, I'm going to have to suspend you for, or put you on detention for playing with a ball in class. They said, but sir, there was no ball. You know, what were we doing? But, you know, they still got the detention. So, I mean, simple little example, but, you know, the different responses from different teachers, really simple responses, got completely different results. So really coming up with some of that, those different responses is really important. So that's what we're looking at, how to be different. I guess part of the key to this is noticing things, noticing differences in kids. Have you seen this? What's that? Oh, did you? You're good. Okay, no, who hasn't? I just, if there's enough. Okay, I'll just show you quickly then. Okay, just go through. Well, getting time at the start of the
class in the master bedroom.
I'm fucking exhorted to go below stairs, sir.
But I was wondering like Julius in the rocking chair.
Pascal, arrest. Lady Smythe.
But how would you know,
madam?
Kids look at this and say, no, it didn't happen.
Clearly, somebody in this room murdered Lord Smythe, who, at precisely 3:34 this afternoon, was brutally bludgeoned to death with a blunt instrument. I will put you to tell me your whereabouts at precisely the time that this dastardly deed took place.
I was punching grass in the last bedroom.
I was buffering his orchard.
So how many, did you pick up any changes, those people hadn't seen it? It's amazing. I mean, you feel like a real idiot, don't you? When you see that the whole, just about everything in there had changed. And I guess the point is that there's a lot of behaviours that we don't notice about the kids that if we did notice, we could use to our advantage. And that's the whole key to the solution-focused approach, is picking up what's different, noticing those differences, and then working in how you can use those differences to help the kids change their behaviour, or change your relationship to those kids, or change the interaction that occurs between you and those kids. And you guys are actually at the forefront of this because you know that a lot of the kids that get into trouble will say, we get into trouble a lot in maths, we get into trouble a lot in the writing, reading and writing sort of subjects. But when it comes down to some of the technic subjects, some of the PE health subjects, they actually do okay. And they say they're the things they enjoy. So often when you say what's different about those subjects, the conversation I have around them is often in areas like sports or practical subjects or their hobbies, things like that. And you can, a lot comes out that they can tell me, well, it is different because this is what I do in there. I don't do my normal pattern of behaviour in those subjects because... And they start giving me these explanations about why they can actually behave, why they can show motivation, why they can do what they're told, why they can have a good relationship with you in this subject that's so different from the other subjects. Once I know what's happening in one, it's easy to translate that into others. So this is most certainly of great value to you, both when you're working with the kids, but also in working with the schools, because people will say, sometimes you're at the firing line because they'll say to kids, "Oh no, we're suspending them." And you're saying, "Well, this kid's no problem in my class," or and being able to advocate for the kids a little bit or give people an impression of a different side of them. So I'm not going to go through this very much. It's just as a reference to you. That they're the sort of the key players. There's been a history over time. These are the key general systems theory, cybernetics, you know, the way feedback occurs and how one small change can actually go back into the system and create bigger changes. And it looks at restraint. You know, and restraint is not holding the kids down. It's more... what stops a kid from behaving as opposed to why they're behaving? Because we ask that question all the time and we never really get a satisfactory answer, or we never can get to the bottom of it. But just sort of working out what is it that stops the kid from behaving just normally and responding. And sometimes that's a little bit of easier question to answer. So have a look at those. And I like in this approach, it's a bit like a mobile. Kids' mobile, you know, what happens with a mobile, it's delicately balanced, but to move any part of the mobile often, you don't have to touch all of it. You've just got to influence one little piece, and because of the nature of the balance between things, it ripples through every other part of that mobile. Or sometimes I sort of think it's a bit like a knot. You know, when you get a tangle, and if you've got a climbing rope or something, you get a tangle in it, and you think, oh, look, it's a mess. And then you just pull, if you pick the one bit to pull, and that loop comes out, and the whole thing just unravels. It's not a big knot. It's just one little piece will unravel it and get it sorted. Or a Picasso. All the pieces are there. They're just in different places than we'd expect them to be. And sometimes that just makes it a little bit more interesting, trying to work out. But we have a sense of what's happening, but we don't need to understand. It doesn't have to be in the spaces where we think they are. Sometimes it's more interesting just to explore where they are. So, and I'll just go through quickly, and I guess where this is coming from, if you're interested in the psychology of it, you know, we had this idea when science came into the fore, you know, breaking everything down into its pieces. We got good at sort of saying, let's break it down, find out how things work, you know, that clockwork sort of style. And if we can find out how each piece works, we can put it together and it explains it. But that was actually found to be not terribly satisfactory. We couldn't always understand just the logic behind the whole thing by looking at the pieces. We had to look at systems, whether it was in biology or whether it was in physics or whatever. Things didn't just happen because of the parts. They happened when they were all together. Something else happened. So this is when this guy sort of started looking at the whole systems of things. And it wasn't just in psychology, it was across all the areas. They realized that reductionism wasn't just the only way to look at things. And you had a whole heap of things come out of it. You know, this is where the chaos theory idea, you know, the butterfly flicking its wings in wherever and then, you know, a monsoon in China and all that stuff. And some management, businesses started working on this principle as well, looking at the whole organisation. It filtered through the thinking. It's not just in education, it's not just in psychology. So, look, and this is what I'm trying to say, a car is more than the sum of its parts. And I'll give you an example. If I had to rebuild that car, I could put it together, everything would be in working order. I put the petrol, put the oil in, turn the ignition, it's not necessarily going to work. Because I've got to tune it. I've got to get it right. I've got to get everything in a balance with each other so that when I hit that ignition, everything comes at the same time. It's that balance, it's that tuning that's really important. And you can't really define that. It's not something that happens. And you know, with mechanics, some people just have that knack. They can just tune it. And it's like they tune it by their ear, or they tune it by their feel, or they've just got a way of making the car perform better because they just have a sense of the totality of the engine and the car, and they just feel it. And it's not something that you can just pull aside and say, it's this part. So there's a few assumptions in this, and I just go through these because they do create a little bit of an understanding of where it's coming from. It works on that people are really trying to make sense of things. No matter who you are, you're trying to make sense of it. And even if you do that really poorly, don't wake up in the morning and say, I'm not going to be aware of what's going around me. And people experience problems, but they don't like them. I've never known a kid that says, I really like being in trouble. You know, they like getting kicked out of school, or they might like getting kicked out of class or not having to do the work, but if you ask them, do you like the hassle, do you like all that conflict, they'll say no. And just because you have a problem doesn't mean that it's part of you. There's nothing wrong with you necessarily. I mean, okay, I won't ask you to do this, but, you know, put up your hand if you haven't got any problems. I mean, it wouldn't. Yeah, I know, there's one of you there. But, you know, like, we all have issues that we're constantly working through. It doesn't make us good, bad people, all those things. And we tend to sort of say, oh, kids are damaged. I hear that all the time, kids are damaged. And this approach doesn't believe that. It doesn't believe kids are sick if they're having bad behaviour. It just means they're having issues, just like all of us, in various degrees. So they're not saying, well, we have to fix them. And generally, people have tried to sort things out. They don't wake up in the morning saying, I'm going to have a really bad day today. They really wake up in the morning thinking it's all going to be good today, but they just get into the same patterns, do the same things, and the same stuff results. So trying to break those patterns is really hard. And most people have within them some ways of coping. Even the most desperate of people have some resource, well, you would hope. I've met some pretty desperate people, and that assumption I've questioned, but it's generally true. And this one, it sounds a bit funny, the problem's the problem. And what we often do is we associate the problem with the person. We say, oh, this kid's just a troublemaker, or this kid is... But it's just the problem. The problem is the problem, and we deal with that. It's not about the person. It's not about everything else. It's not about their family. It's not about whether they're making me angry. It's just the problem's the problem. Let's focus on it. And everything changes. So let's go with that. Let's assume that things are going to change. They can either change for the better, the worse, but they're going to change. Things don't stay the same. Today's not the same as tomorrow. Can't be. And there's always exceptions. And I think that's one of the easiest questions to ask a kid. When is it different? When does this not happen? And they might fish around for a bit, but they usually come up with one. And sometimes you can reframe the issue. I'll give you a classic example of this. When we were doing the wilderness stuff, the kids that were oppositional, the kids that were defiant, difficult, stubborn, determined, all those things in school, when you get them out in the bush, guess what? They're the kids that do. They're the kids that want to get to the top of the mountain first. They're the kids that when the going gets tough, they just keep going a little bit. They want to be the first to be at, you know, standing at the lookout. They want to not stop halfway up a hill. Whereas other kids will be at the bottom of the hill, virtually sitting on their pack, sort of waiting for the erosion to make it a few metres shorter so that they can, don't have to climb up it. You know, and you can sort of think, it's not going to get any smaller just sitting there. And these other kids are at the top. So out there, they're persistent, they're determined, they persevere. So it's still the same kid with the same behaviour, it's just defined differently. It's just described differently. It's just framed differently. So often we'd go back to schools and we'd say, hey, that kid, you know, he's really ambitious, he's really determined, he's really likes to persevere and persist. And they say, yeah. I remember going to one school and they said, yeah, well, look, I've noticed when I give him the drums and music, he's really good. When I give him the keyboard, we have a problem. And the teachers virtually just worked it out themselves. If we treat him like he's determined and ambitious, we see his behaviour in a different way and we respond to it differently. And by responding to it differently, we get a different outcome. Because I don't see he's challenging me. I see him wanting to take a lead. And if I give him that lead, then I have no problems. And it's all just on two words being switched over in that teacher's mind from being defiant to being determined or ambitious. And, it's an easy thing to do. And if it works, don't fix it. So it's not about getting kids to do certain things or think certain. If it's working for them, leave it. And this is one of the hardest things for a lot of people. You don't need to know what the problem is. One of the interesting things with solution focused, it doesn't need to have a diagnosis. It doesn't believe in labelling kids with ADD, ODD, you know, ED, BD, conduct disorder. It says it doesn't make any difference. That is just putting a label on it that's trapping our thinking into a certain way. Forget the labels. The labels are just our way of trying to give definition to something we can't define. We've got a problem, we can't do something with it, so we give it a name and that makes us feel better. And so we don't need to know what the problem is. We can still do something about it. So there's a few approaches. And these are really, really, really very simple if you've got the right attitude to go in with it. The first thing you can ask is these exception questions. And it's just asking, have you always had this problem? I ask it sometimes, when was your last good year at school? And they'll say, oh, I had a good year in year four, year five. What was different about that year? I had a really good teacher. So what's a good teacher look like for you? They're saying, oh, well, you know, and they start giving me all these things that work for them. So these are all the exceptions that are starting to give me an understanding of how things can be different for this kid, and that they've had an experience of something being different for them. So the coping question is, you know, kids will say, oh, you know, I'm hopeless, or I'm, you know, this one where I'm depressed. You say, well, how do you manage when you're depressed? What do you do to get through the day? Oh, well, I just... And they start giving you all these things that they're doing that are helping them. Now, often we just constantly talking about what's not working for them. We just elevate all the things that are going wrong, and that's all we want to talk about. So by asking them, how do you cope? What works for you? And the classic one, I gave you the example of the kid refereeing. That's a classic example. How do you cope with your temper when parents abuse you, when you got the whistle? And the kid was able to tell me, well, I just do all these things. And it doesn't take very much for them to realise, well, if I do it then, maybe I should just do that at school and I'll be right. Because it's not like we have to teach them what to do. This kid knows what to do because he does it 3-4 hours a day, you know, a weekend, every weekend. He's got it down pat. He just doesn't do it when he's at school. So it's just a simple little switch to get him to do the same thing. And, you know, that makes a big difference. Because, you know, as soon as that kid is different in a class, teacher responds differently, he responds differently to the different response, and you get this snowball effect. And sometimes I think all I've got to do in getting a kid back from suspension is get them to, when they walk in the building, to have 10 good minutes. And there's one school that's got a really challenging situation for the kids, because the principal, when they come back from school, really rides the kids and puts them down. It's a terrible situation, but we know what happens. So you got to get the kid through the first 10 minutes. So you just say, you know, we just work on it a fair bit, because if they get through the first 10 minutes, suddenly the whole situation changes. It's like the principal says, oh, well, looks like you're different. Oh, almost like, here's a chocolate frog, and, you know, what can I do to help you? Do you need any? It's like this complete change in attitude. It's a bit freaky in a way, but if the kids can get through that 10 minutes, everything can change. And suddenly, now they're leaving the office not all fired up, ready to take it out in the first class they walk into. They're now feeling, oh, that went really well, and they walk into class a bit more... with their head up, and then people respond to them as if they're happy to see them, and the whole snowball effect happens. And one of the tools for looking at what's different is these scaling questions. And it's a bit like the emotional temperature graph, but what you're looking at is that movement between things a little bit more. So there's some questions, you know, what would... And I'll just run through it really quickly. This is the example. You know, I give the kid 0 to 10 and just say, where are you now? 0 is really the worst sort of situation. It's not about your emotions. It's more about how successful you're being or how much you've got this problem at school. Where are you? Are things pretty good at school? And they might say, yeah, I'm a 3. I've just come back from suspension. And you say, okay, now where were you last week? And I might know that last week was a really bad week. They had a short suspension for 3 days. So they say, oh, last week I was down at a 1. Now, I want to know, isn't this... I just want to know what's different about this week to last week. Last week was terrible. This week's going okay. So what made it better? What did you do? And kids said, oh, you know, I realised I just had to come to school and put my head down, shut up. So now the kid's telling me how they can fix their problem to get to a 3. So that's not enough, but I can ask the next question, well, you know, where would you like to be? Or what would it look like if you were at a 5? So, you know, you're going up. 5 looks pretty good. What would it look like if you were a 5? What would be different? And kids will say, oh, you know, I might move up the front. I wouldn't be talking to my mates. I get my work done. Now, they're just little things, but it's just getting the kids to think about fixing the problem as opposed to trying to say, well, why do you do it? Well, why are you in so much trouble? And then going through all those questions. And then this one's an interesting one, because where would you like to be? And the kids don't say, oh, I'd like to be at a 1, so I'm suspended. They'll say, oh, yeah, 8. Not many kids will say 10, because that sounds a bit nerdy. But an 8, what would it look like if you were an 8? And they'll come over, if I was an 8, my dad would buy me a motorbike, because he said if I wasn't in trouble, I'd get a motorbike. So you get a motorbike. So if you were an 8, you'd be riding around the motorbike come Christmas time. What else would you be doing? Oh, well, I wouldn't be in the dummies classes. I hate being in the dummies class because I'm not that dumb. I just don't know how to do anything. And so they start talking through what it would be like. And they're not talking fairy stories here. They're talking about real things that can happen. So getting them thinking about what they need to do to get up there. And what would it look like? So this question is the fourth one. It's not one that I've used a lot, but I just put it in here to show you. It's an interesting question in this approach, and it's working out if you have a. It's really asking this question, like if you woke up one morning and you've been touched by this angel while you slept, and you no longer had the problem that's been an issue for you. How would you know in the morning that you'd been fixed? What would you know? You know, what would be the indicators? And this is where it gets hard for the kids to sort of put themselves in a situation like this. But it's an interesting question when you think about it. Well, someone that might have a really quick temper might say, oh, well, you know, something... people would start being more friendly to me. People would come up and talk to me and wouldn't, you know, back off when I walk in the room. Or all these things. So they start going through looking at the solution and what it would look like and how they would respond and what they would do. And so that's where that comes in. So I'll just pass on this because I really want to get to this. Externalization. This is the one that is quite a useful one. And this is really quite fun. And you've got to be careful that it's not a... doesn't become the demon within you type discussion. But what you're saying... And I'll tell you the kid I've used it with a lot. You know, the kid that's got a really quick temper. And they'll say, oh, I don't know what drives me. So you know, trying to break it down, the emotional temperature, they can't really see those steps, they just doesn't quite work for them. And you're talking to them and you're saying, and sometimes I walk in and I can see that they're already ready to snap. They've just got that tension. And I'll say to them, in terms of this externalization, I say, well, look, mate, looks like psychos walked in the room. And we start giving this, we give the problem a name, and that's just one you can make up anything. You can call it Fred. I'll say, Fred's in the room. Mate, you know, I can see Fred's about to snap. Where's Jared? Jared was in here yesterday, Fred's in here today. You know, and we start having this conversation and we give the problem the bad temper a name. We call it Fred. I say, mate, you must be sick of Fred being around, you know. Everyone likes you. And then Fred sort of starts giving you advice. Fred starts to snap. And, you know, next minute you're on the roof and the police are dragging you down. And that's not got to be good. And he says, no, I hate it. I say, well, you know, how do you tell Fred to piss off? You know, when do you tell Fred to go away? And he says, oh, I don't. Fred just barges in the door. And we start having this conversation about Fred. Now, if I said, oh, mate, you got a bad temper problem, let's talk about that, the kid's going to say, oh, yeah, well, you know, people shouldn't piss me off. But we start talking about Fred. So is Fred working for you? Is Fred making life easy for you? No. No, Fred makes my life hell. If I didn't have Fred around, things would be good. When Fred's not there, I get on with people. So how do you tell him to piss off? How do you know he's around? How do you know he's at the door trying to take over? Oh, well, you know, if I have an argument with Mum, Fred's always there. So I say, so when you have an argument with Mum, you bring Fred to school and Fred takes over and tells the teachers what to do. So how do you tell Fred not to come to school with you? And it's hard to sort of just go through without you seeing it. But it just becomes such an easy conversation because we're talking about this problem as an external entity. And it's just an easy, it's just a language tool. It's nothing else, but you've got to be careful. It's not like, oh, you know, the demon within you making you do this sort of stuff. It's not about that. It's just about giving the problem a name that you can then talk through and talk about how you're going to, how they're going to keep Fred away. What works? What works when Fred's not there? So it's just a really good way of separating the person from the problem. And there's a little bit more on that, but I just want to get through this. And I'm not going to go through this. You can look it up. There's a way of talking to the kids, and this is just a script. Have a look if you're interested. We've gone through most of it, but I will go through this one because this is quite a fun one to do that can be very helpful. In dealing with difficult people, it works. It's used as a bullying. You know, we've got that classic line, if you're being bullied, ignore them. If you tell a teacher, you know, all that sort of stuff, ask them to stop. And it's a good start, but sometimes we need something more for kids. So if they're having to deal with someone, the first thing is to ignore it, but not to really ignore it, just to ignore the reaction to it. So sometimes that's tricky. It's just saying something else. But most bullies and things don't take well to ignoring because they'll just keep going until they, especially for the kids that, you know, have buttons to be pushed. The other kids know that if they keep going, they're going to push their buttons. So this is the one that the kids sometimes find hard. If they're saying, oh, sir, that shirt you're wearing today, that's a bit old school, you know, that's a bit daggy, then what I would do, I'd agree with them. Oh, yeah, you know, St. Vinny's, I have to start shopping somewhere else, you know. They're just not getting the good stuff anymore. So I just agree. Takes the wind out of their sails. Sometimes that might be enough. And that's a classic line, you know, just to agree. Getting the kids to do that is sometimes hard. But so this is the one that often I like, and this one works really well with a lot of situations. So if you can't ignore them and you've agreed with them but they just still want to keep going, confuse them. And this is where I've seen this work so many times on kids. I've seen it work with two kids fronting each other, ready to have a fight. You know how they get into that stage, who's going to swing first? And someone will just say, I remember it in an overhang in the Butterwangs once, a guy just said, which of you kids were, you know, carrying the frying pan today? And they both just looked over and said, what? We didn't have a frying pan. And then when they turned back, it just it wasn't there anymore. It had just gone. If a kid will say to me, you know, I've said about my shirts and vinnies, they say, oh, sir, you poor, you're a real povo, you know, and just keep going on it, I'll just say, well, I use a variety of things. Sometimes if I'm feeling really a bit bizarre, I'll just say, well, you know, and the thing is, pineapples seem to be really spiky this time of year, and I don't know what it is. You know, what do you think? And they say, what? What are you talking about? Or sometimes if I got a couple of the Islander boys in there, they want to start with a bit of, you know, antagonism, I might just say, I don't think Canterbury are going to win another premiership ever. And they say, what? Yeah, they will. And it's complete, and they've just gone completely off track. And one thing about bullies or people teasing, they lose their momentum. And the other thing is, if they don't quite get where you're coming from, it's a bit scary for them. This is not the reaction they expected. They're really happy when you're going to pieces or when you're arguing with them. But if you don't argue and you just give them something a little bit bizarre, they sort of think, oh, is he having a go at me? I don't know what's going on here. This is getting too hard. I think I'll just pick this other guy because he's nice and simple. He just goes, cries when I say things to him. So confusing. And it's something you can rehearse with the kids because it doesn't need to have any context. You can just say, oh, you want to pick the pineapples, you want to pick the football, you want to pick something else. Just pick an area and go. And it works for you too. Because, you know, kids do like to push your buttons. So sometimes you can do it. And then this one is the exaggerate. So I like the example here. You know, if someone's with the girls, they say, you're a slut. You know, say, oh, well, you know, you bet. And just make a big thing of it. Because what usually happens is the other kids, the other kids standing alongside, they know you're not just agreeing with them at this point. You are really making a joke of it in a way and taking it one step further. The other kids sort of all laugh with you. And this kid now is sort of feeling like, well, no, I don't quite get it. This is not the way I wanted to go. But everyone seems to be enjoying it except for me. So again, I'm going to back off here. So I have some interesting conversations around this because, you know, especially with the parents, because it comes up all the time, especially with the girls in some of the schools, you know, where they have a go at their mothers and what their mothers are like and things and call their mothers all sorts of names. And I say, well, just agree with them. I say, you know, is your mother a... And she looks and sort of... No. But, so it's a really simple step, and you can apply this. As I say, it's perfect when those kids love to have a little go at you. Might be what you're wearing or something, your shoes or something, you know, and you just do it. Sometimes it doesn't work to ignore it. You can agree with it, confuse them, and then exaggerate. And it's just that, it's working on that whole principle. It's just throwing something different into the equation that's twisting things, that's having a bit of a snowball effect in different ways. Okay, so you guys want a bit of a break? Have 5 minute break, and then can we come back? Okay, let's go. And have a look at this. Okay, while the others are coming back, because what I really want to do is sort of try to show you some resources in this line. So, really just want to look at, not, there's a lot of lot of people sort of say, throwing a lot of technology around, sort of saying, let's give people stuff. But why give them stuff? What stuff works? How does it work? What are we going to do with the stuff to make it work? And I don't know if you've seen people using technology in schools well. I must say, I haven't. There are some people doing some really good things. If you talk to the Department of Education about their technology, they've got some great programs going. The programs they've got going seem to be working really well with the kids that don't need it. They've got some really advanced game design program. They've got, you know, Murder Under the Microscope, where 30,000 kids get on for 6 weeks trying to solve a mystery. But those, the 30,000 kids that are online are the 30,000 kids that are already doing their homework, already doing well at school. And when you talk about what are we doing to get those kids that aren't engaged in school, that aren't working in their classrooms engaged, it doesn't seem to be a lot happening. And we've got the laptop program. What year, now? I think 3 years now, or year 10, year 9 have got them. And there's still. I know my daughter came home and said, "Dad, can you buy me some books?" I said, "Oh, you don't need one. You got a laptop." They said, "Teacher won't let us use the laptop." Well, I said, "Tell the teacher I'm not buying books. You got a laptop." And she said, "Oh, I can't do that." But it just seems so senseless. I mean, she types faster than she writes. She's got OneNote. She can organise things. That's the way she does it. She has to reorganise them. She can do it all in one go on OneNote. And that's what she would prefer to do. But the teacher can't handle it. So they're not doing it. But that's another example of a kid that would cope either way. But what about those kids that aren't succeeding? How can we do it? And it's really amazing what happens when those kids get the technology and how they use it. So we'll look at that. But first, just looking at where the technology is in education and getting a perspective. We've got a lot of technology in schools doing the accounts, reports, all those things. You know, the timetables, it's all computerised now. We've got a lot just putting up, you know, displaying information. I don't know how many assignments I've got from schools for kids on suspension, and the guy says, go to the internet and look up something. And I've tried to look up this, and I can't find any reasonable information that a kid this age would understand about this topic. It's just, you know, yeah, Google will give me 3.5 million websites, and they're all crap. If I've got a degree in forestry, I might be able to understand what they're talking about when they're doing timber. But if they're asking me what are the different characteristics of hardwoods and softwoods, it's not giving me that answer. It's giving me all this other stuff. And for a kid who struggles with discerning the information, it's you might as well walk them into the library in here and say, look, go and look up this question. There's a million books in here. It's got to be in here somewhere. Go to it. You know what they're going to do? They're not going to do it. So we've got a lot. We've got organisation. You know, there's a whole heap of system. We've got the networks. We've got video conferencing. This is a big thing. All these schools have $10,000 classrooms with video conferencing. I've asked how many schools have done a video conference. Like, no one said they've done one yet. Oh, the teachers have done one. They did an in-service on them. But in terms of, and I don't know how useful it is for my kids in the suspension centre to go to the Australian Museum and walk around the dinosaur exhibition with some professor from Sydney University. They're not going to relate to that. And that person can't see my kids and see what's going to relate to them in the same way. So, and then, you know, we've got all the various softwares and things. And then there's this other area where we've got, you know, online learning programs. We've got the video conferencing, the handheld devices. But look, this is the technology that's out there. But if you look at it, all these ones are not interactive. That's, you know, the classic Web 1. Now, Web 1 was pre-2001, you know, before computers had the ability to respond to the user. And that's the Web 2, which is where that technology suddenly became able to know that you were there and respond differently to depending on your response. Now, this was a big change in the technology, and it made things incredibly different, especially for education, but for business, for everything. But this really has a big implication for us, but nearly all our stuff is, we're still working at Web 1. We're still working pre-2001. There's not much happening in this area, especially in assessment. We're asking kids to collaborate, to go online, to do stuff. And if I see successful kids, they're often online with the Board of Studies, you know, not the real Board of Studies, you know, the BORED of studies. They're conferring with other students. They're Facebooking essay questions. They're doing all this. They're getting all their information. And I don't know how many conversations I've had with my daughters, and they said, you know, it's just so stupid. They still want us to go in and memorise 30 quotes for an English example, you know, an English exam. How dumb is that? We can look them up, we can do whatever. We don't need to memorise the quotes, but that's what we've got to do well in a HSC. So I reckon it's a bit like this little guy. What we're asking kids to do these days is we're saying, we want to know how well you drive a car, so what we'll do is we'll check how well you ride a bike, and that will give us a good idea. So if you can ride a bike, you got your driver's license. Because, you know, we're asking them to memorise, do the rote learning, write an essay, all the stuff, and then we say, yeah, but that's not really what you're going to do. You're going to have to use the computer, you're going to have to be creative, you're going to have to collaborate, you're going to have to use high-level thinking, you have to be synthesise your information, you have to discern the information that's relevant for you from a whole heap of range of sources. But just for the to judge how smart you are and how good you are at 12 years of school, we're going to ask you to do one question, and we want you to write this answer. Don't write too much. Don't be too creative, because it'll confuse us and we won't be able to mark it. Just give us what we want. So this is a big area. Our assessment's so based on the old system that it makes it difficult. So that's just my little rant. Let's have a look quickly at what we can learn from various different areas that might teach us about why technology can work with kids to motivate them. And I'm just going to look at four areas. You know, what we know about technology and how it's worked, learning theory generally, and engaging kids with special needs, what's worked in the past to get kids engaged, and then understanding those kids. So let's go quickly and have a look at one of these kids. Liam's my classic kid. He's a year 8 kid, but he reads at a year 3 level. He's almost non-functional, but he can read. I know he can read. He can discern the letters. He can actually put them into words. So he's not a non-reader. He's not illiterate. He just doesn't read. His maths is well behind. He was a kid, really hasn't been in school since about year 4. Year 5 and 6, he just was constantly out and about doing stuff. And year 7 and 8, he's been either truanting or on suspension. Likes motorbikes, likes graffiti. So gave him this little exercise. And we thought it would be a bit of a challenge. It's just a really simple little design on the notebook software, on the interactive whiteboard. Very simple software. It's too simple for a lot of things, but it's great for teachers who haven't developed. It just creates these lovely little flash resources that you can do. This is one we made, fairly visual. You can almost work out. Liam actually looked at it and worked it out pretty well without reading it. I thought he might get, you know, not follow the instructions. But he just worked out straight away, and he wanted to go up. He went up to the whiteboard, and this is what he did. He just started clicking. He could work out what it was. He had no trouble going through. You know, and as soon as he knew, it wasn't that one, he went straight to the next one. And he just finished it. He got 70%, and that's what he did. He went straight back and reset it and wanted to start again. And he just worked through it. Now, watching him was really funny, because this kid hadn't done a maths worksheet for, as far as I could work out, 3 or 4 years to finish it. He did 10 that first time, and as he worked through each example, he got the red cross. It was a big red cross, wasn't it? Wasn't subtle. Didn't say, "Oh, you're a really good boy. Why don't we try that again?" You know, it just said, "No, mate, you're stuck. That was stupid." But he didn't. He wasn't fazed by it. He said, "Oh, yeah, it's that one down there. That was my second choice." And he went straight to it, and he just kept moving through. And this was funny, because if I'd have put the red cross on there, he would have said, "Oh, right, this is stupid. What am I going to do for this? You know. I don't need to make change. They just give me the change. You know, the maths is boring." But he didn't argue with the computer at all. He went straight to that next answer. Now when he finished, he went back and he just went straight to the reset button. And he did it again. And when he did it again, he got 80%. He still had two that he mucked up. You know, the two little... the ones that you could go either way with. And so he said, "No," I said, "80%'s not bad. 80%'s close to mastery." Well, it is mastery. And he said, "No." He said, I know what the two I did wrong. I'll do it again." And he did it. He did it about 3 times before, and I really had to drag him off. And the only way I could drag it off him was to say, "Hey, do you want to make change of $50? And he said, yeah, give me another one." So we went up to $50. And he did another 3. So here he is. He hasn't finished a thing. He's now done 60 examples with about somewhere between a 70, well, it would have averaged out to be about an 85-95% completion, you know, like success rate. And what's doing it? It's not that whiz bang. It's really basic technology. But there's something in that that's working for him. And that's what I'm trying to... You know, it's really interesting to have this helps us have a look at it. So, just going to go through reasonably quickly. Use of technology seems to come... They've looked at this from two ways. We learn from the technology, or we learn with the technology. Learning from is where the computer is giving us the information. It's just providing us with a means of accessing learning. Now, we're learning with the technology is slightly different. It's where we are interacting with it and going through a different process. So, as I say, from, it's like a tutor. It's a bit like rote learning. You know, it's doing those little examples where, you know, the computer just keeps feeding us up things and we're doing stuff. And the learning with, where we tend to be a little bit more higher level, where we're doing those situated learning tasks, or if it's problem-based. You know, we'll get a problem, simulation games, things like that, where we have to immerse ourselves in them, and you need the technology to work it out, and the technology keeps throwing things. It's a bit in the area of gaming in a way, but on those principles in some way. What it's really saying is that if we want to get kids actively involved in the learning, the learning with technology seems to have a much better result. Though both of them seem to work, but they can't actually work out what it is about the technology that's making a difference. The only thing that seems to be the bottom line is that the teachers who are using the technology generally happen to be the more sparky teachers. And so they don't really know if it's the technology making a difference or just that the teachers that are using it are the teachers that would always be a little bit upbeat or a little bit creative, a little bit exciting. And so the kids are responding to that. So that's an interesting... The jury's still out on that, because it's really hard to define, you know, what makes the difference, because The technology is not being used out of a context, and maybe the context is the key. So that gives us a little bit of a picture, but not much. Let's have a look at learning theory, and this is a bit simple. But if we looked at learning from two ways, you know, if we break it down into have explicit teaching, you know, very clear directions, break the task down into steps and work through them, that's one way of teaching. If you don't know how to do it, you go back and do it again and just remediate. And then there's the other way, which is saying give kids problems and let them work on the whole task. And this sort of style of teaching. Now, I think both of these have the teacher in a different role, don't they? When you're doing the explicit teaching, you're the teacher's out the front and you're being, it's very much like I'm doing now. You know, I'm talking to you. And in a way, I'm sort of talking at you. You're not directly involved. You know, it's my job to make it simple, you know, structured in a way that you can understand it and help you understand it. And of course, with the contextual teaching, the teacher's a lot more at the side, helping them, you know, being a bit of a guide and a coach. So, I guess in both of those, I find that the kids have a different response. If I'm up the front, to me, the kids say, no, I'm not doing that. You know, I don't want to do it. They react to me telling them, you know, being the person that's the harbinger of bad news, like you've got to do this exercise. Now, if I give them the big task and say, look, this is up to you. You can do it any way you like. I'll help you. You tell me what you want to do and I'll show you how to do it. I'll guide you through it. The kids that are unmotivated, just they look at it and they see those problem-based or the projects type things and they sort of say, I got no idea how to do this. I haven't completed anything that I've had to do. I can't get through the simple little jobs. How do you expect me to work out how to structure this project? Where do I start from? What do I do? Where do I get the information? What's the question? I don't even get what the question means. And they just say, oh, stuff that. I'm not doing it. I can't do it. You know, it's too complicated. So, and this has been one of the problems with a lot of the technology we've put out. We've put it out into things. You know, the classic example was the old web quests. And I know they've renamed them now. What do they call them? The wraps. You know, the little wraps. And it's just giving kids like a problem to solve. But for the kids that are unmotivated, they just say, yeah, but that'll take me 5-6 hours to work through that, and they don't know where to start. So Liam liked his example because there was only 10 of them, and he knew he could do it in 10 minutes less, and so he would. So there's a bit in there that we can use, but let's see what else we've got. So kids that have been identified as ED, BD, learning difficulties, we've had a number of approaches over the years. We tend to either do individualised remedial programs. We say they're deficit in stuff. You know, they can't do stuff, so we'll go through and do it again with them. We'll help them in small settings with individual programs, with support people, and we'll help them get it right this time. So those programs have been a bit repetitive, but they tend to, you know, they can be successful because the kids can see where they're improving. And then we get the other ones, these alternative programs where, you know, it might be a completely different learning environment. It might be outdoor education based, you know, where kids are immersing themselves in a whole heap of experiences and learning through experiential education and all that sort of stuff. And again, it's fairly individualised. But you're working on the life skills, the vocational skills, and, you know, building in the learning through those. Now, both those seem to work, whichever approach we use, as long as we have a positive relationship with the students. So there's not much sort of coming out of them. No one sort of says do one or the other. They seem to both work as long as we've got a positive rapport with the kids. So it's not giving us a lot of information either. So you get a bit of a sense of what you can build into programs to make them work. But we know all this stuff, so it's maybe this might give us a bit of an idea, understanding the next generation. Now, you guys are all in this. This is anyone from 1990 onwards. if you were... See, it's funny. The kids have got no concept that there was an era when people didn't carry around phones. They just don't get that. You know, what was that? Was that in the Neanderthal? The cavemen didn't have mobile phones? But everyone else did. Civilized life has had a mobile phone. And they've got no concept of life without an internet. And when you think of it, it's not that long ago when computers... you used to think it was fantastic. I remember using a computer that had 124 megabytes of memory on it, thinking, geez, this is going to... Where am I going to put everything? It's just... It's going to have so much space. Your stick doesn't even... It's just changed so much. So what do we understand about this next generation, these digital natives? First of all, and this doesn't help when I'm doing a two-hour lecture, you guys have got short, informal learners and you've got short attention span. And that doesn't mean you can't concentrate or anything like that. It just means you like things to move. You like things to move along. You like things to change. You don't like, sticking to the same thing all the time. But informal learners, what that means is, if I'll give you a classic example. My mother lost a recipe the other day. She said, I can't find the passion fruit shortcake recipe. And she was like, I've lost it. Now, I just said, well, did you Google it? And I think she thought I was swearing at her. If we want to find out something, you either Facebook or text your friend, or you just Google it. And if Google doesn't know, then it's not known, is it? That's it. And even if you can't even spell it, say it, Google will find it anyway. Say, don't you mean this, you idiot? So that's the informal learners. You guys go and find stuff for yourself. You don't need to be told it because you will get it. So the other thing is that because you can do that, you tend to look and try different things. You tend to go and be a bit lateral in your thinking. Go out and explore. Be prepared to jump across new ideas because the new ideas are happening all the time. And lateral thinking, if you know what lateral thinking is, it's making that little jump. I've mostly only got time to give an example of lateral thinking. I'll give you a quick example of lateral thinking. This is a joke. I hope I don't offend anybody. But humour is where lateral thinking comes in, and it's making this little lateral leap that Edward de Bono talks about. But, okay, there's a pretty young woman, and she's got an oldish but very rich husband. Sorry for the stereotypes. It just works for the joke. Anyway, they decide to go out to the opera, and they've got, of course, they're rich, so they've got a butler, and they say to the butler, look, Jeeves, will you... look after the place for us. We'll be back midnight. So he says, yes, ma'am, no problem. So 9 o'clock comes, the door opens, the mistress of the house walks in, unexpected, takes one look at Jeeves and says, Jeeves, to the bedroom. And so Jeeves is the butler. He does what he's told. He goes to the bedroom. And she says, Jeeves, take off my dress. So Jeeves does what he's told. He takes off a dress. Says, Jeeves, slip off my stockings. So 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 Jeeves does what he's told. He slips off his stockings. He says, "Jeeves, remove my bra." So Jeeves removes the bra. And then she says, "Jeeves, if I ever catch you wearing my clothes again, you'll be immediately dismissed." Now, some of you took longer, didn't it? Some of you took longer. You were on a wavelength there and you weren't going to change. And it's funny. It is really funny. The bigger the space. I remember doing that once when there must have been about a couple of hundred people. And it was like this. It just kept going. It was like a seismic wave. The first round got it. And then the others sort of looked and thinking, what are they laughing about? And then they got it, and it just went. And what it was doing is suddenly you were moving along on a certain tact in your thinking, and then the punchline comes, and you had to sort of say, no, I don't get it. That's not where I... So you make this jump. You actually jump this chasm and said, oh, now I get. My whole thinking here was wrong. But now I've got a new way of thinking. Now I understand what was the story here. And you've just made this, you know, it's the beginning of creativity, of invention, of understanding things. It's that jump. We use it in humour because there's sort of some sort of enjoyment in that process. But that's the same with invention. You know, everyone tries a certain thing. Someone tries something different. And it just sort of jumps out at them. And that's what that lateral thinking is. So these guys, you guys actually dislike anything slow. And I think for some kids in school, the teachers, it must sound like this to them. It really must sound like this. Because of the pace they work at, the way they're used to using their computer, and the way that they look at TV and do things. When a teacher walks in, this is what they're hearing. "Good morning, everybody. Get your books out. Turn to chapter 5. This is an exciting lesson on coastal geomorphology." Yeah, and they're just saying, "Come, you know, where's the pictures? Where's the what are we doing?" Because things come at you quickly. You're used to taking it. You're used to coming at them quickly. When we look at the movies, you know, someone my age looks at the Matrix movies, and we sort of try to work out, what the hell's going on? You know, maybe if I watch it 3 times, I'll work it out. Now, you know, my daughter watches it and says, "You know, Dad, didn't you get the subplots? You know, there was this plot, these are the different levels. Or, you know, they were doing this. This is how they were going, and they got it." You guys watch stuff. You see, you take in the less than two second grabs make sense to you, whereas we were used to things coming to us in 5 seconds grabs. You know, you did a scene for 5 seconds, you changed the shot, moved to the next one. Now it's anywhere between half a second to 2 seconds, and that's all. The information is just firing. Your brains work at that level. So when we do things differently, it doesn't excite us. It's just so slow. And I think you're able to multitask. Now, the jury's a bit out on this. Some people say, "Oh, you multitask, but you do everything badly." Well, I'm not convinced about that. I think quite capable of multitasking, using different devices within the same component. So, let's have a look. I'm just going to look at what. Watching kids with technology, and I'm not going to... The things I notice about them, and this is the stuff from looking at not just my programs, but programs with other... Kids seem to complete things. They're willing to get mastery. the teacher is a lot more relaxed. I'm not being argued with. And I keep asking the kids, I say, how come you don't argue with the computer? The computer tells you wrong, and you don't tell it it's stupid. And they look at me and they say, Ray, you're stupid, you can't argue with a computer. So we argue with everybody else, and for some kids, you know, they come with labels like ODD, oppositional defiant disorder, and I say, how come you're not ODD with a computer? You argue with everybody else, and they just look at me and say, it's pointless to argue with a computer. So this is good, because it means they usually want to argue about the work, and they're not arguing. So, and this is a big one. They like feedback. They like to know they're wrong, as long as they're told straight away, and it's just clear. It's not caged, like, oh, well, do you think you could do that a different way? Or the computer doesn't waste time with that, just puts the red cross up and says, get on with it. And they do. And they really do seem to show like the visuals. And this comes with, a lot of the kids, I think that's why the Aspies and stuff like the computers, they're able to understand it. They can control it in a way, they can let it come at the pace that they can work with, they can see it, it's understandable, they can interpret it. And so they really need to have some sort of system of organising that. So that's where your online learning management system is really important. So what I'm really saying from all that kids that have got learning problems, that have got emotional problems, seem to be a lot more engaged in using the tools if they've got these things in them. And if they haven't, they're just like anything else. And this is a list of 9, but I'll show you the resources as soon as we get through this and as an example. They've got to have that feedback. They've got to be short. If they can't do them in 20 minutes, they're not going to do them. Now, I'm not talking about your high-functioning kids here. We're talking about your kids that don't get things done. If they can't do it in 20 minutes, they're not going to do it because they don't have that sense of success. They don't think they're going to get through it if it takes that long. They know they haven't got a record of success in this way. So if they can see they've got 10 or what they've got to do, they'll do it. And that's really easy on the technology because it shows them all that. It needs to be adaptive. And I'll show you an example in a minute about mathematics. And what adaptive means is that if it's too hard for them, it makes it easier. If it's too easy for them, it makes them harder. So the kids are constantly being pushed. And there's a little lack of predictability about it, which makes it exciting, which makes it challenging. A lot of the kids that are difficult like a challenge. They just do it in inappropriate ways. So they also need to feel like they can work it out. So any technology that seemed to engage the kids also had ways of doing it, ways of finding out how to do it. You know, extra things, little things you could hit that gave a hint, or a way of getting to the answer a different way. So they had an option. And as long as they had the option, they would explore that and try to work it out. And if they didn't, if they used a couple of options and it didn't work, they were quite happy to ask the teacher at that point because they tried a few things for themselves rather than just the one thing. They really had to be presented within some sort of structure. Just putting a kid out and saying, go and research something on Google doesn't work. Even if what they find is interesting and exciting, no structure to it. It needs to be presented within an intranet or a learning management system. And nearly anywhere in the world that's handed out computers have also handed out a learning management system. New South Wales is the only one I can think of that gave out the computers with no learning management system attached. And that seemed to be the key. So it was a real flaw. And the kids need to know where they're going. what they've achieved, how much they've done. They like that feedback. They like to know that they're a lot further. And you know, those kids, it's the gaming. It's to sort of say, well, I'm on level 14. They're very quick, and that's enough to keep them motivated in lots of ways. They can produce attractive work. When they write, they don't mind correcting on the computer because it's easy to correct. It's not scrawling out. They make mistakes. They make mistakes all the time. We all do. But they just make more, and they hate correcting, so they won't do it. They won't write it. They won't put the pen to paper. But on a computer, they know it's just a back button or a cut and paste or whatever. They can fix it. It'll look good. So they're happy to do it. And it doesn't... I haven't seen any successful programs where there wasn't a human involved. Even the online programs, it worked well for those kids that were unmotivated at school. They had a contact person. There's some programs in Britain where they employed people to be up for almost 24 hours. They didn't have to be there face-to-face, but they were on there through either social media or email. Someone could get in touch with them and say, I don't get this. Can you give me a call? And it needed that extra dimension. So we're not out of a job here, and I'll get to that in a moment. And really, they've got to have the multitask and the different media, as much different stimulus in there as possible. So this seems to be the key that's coming out from all of this stuff, that what we're getting is a different teacher role. And that terrible word, pedagogy, what it's doing is there's a different pedagogy. That we are not the experts anymore. Computer, Google knows much more than I'll ever know. All of us will ever know. Because it's that collective intelligence that it's got, or that collective pool of knowledge. So what that means is if I'm not the expert anymore, I'm not the person up the front, then I've got to be something else. But that's good, because when I'm up the front and the expert, all they want to do is shoot me down in flames. So now they're not shooting at me. So what am I doing? I've got to step back and I've got to be more the coach or the guide or a little bit of the facilitator. But that's good, because that's a role that I'm really happy to take, because it's so much more relaxed. You know, they don't argue with it, and this is the thing I can't. I'm in awe of all the time. The kids constantly ask me, "Can we do it again?" I don't think I did that properly. Can I fix it? Can I go over and can I do one more time? And sometimes I got to say, "No, you've got 9 out of 10. You don't need to do it again. You've mastered it." But they want to get it 100% right. And I say, unless you're going to be a brain surgeon or a pilot, you don't need to have 100% success rate. Be happy. Move on to the next thing. But that's a lot better than, no, I'm not doing it. This is stupid. So this, just that one expression. And I guess, just really simply, there's a lot of explicit teaching going on here. We're breaking things down, we're presenting them, but it's being put into what we put onto the computer. It's in, we've got to do the teaching that we used to do in terms of the preparation of the interaction with the kids, now has got to be in the design of the materials we use. And so they provide the direct feedback, the support, all the crappy jobs with the student. And what I'm allowed to do is do the indirect support. And that helps my relationship. The kids aren't at me. They need me. So, you know, it's funny. People can't come in to the suspension centre and they sort of think, oh, how do you control the kids? I say, I don't have to control the kids. All I got to do is help the kids, because they're constantly asking me how do we do stuff or what do I got to do. And it's trying to get to them quick enough to be able to answer their questions. Now, this is not what you're supposed to find in a behaviour school or a behaviour setting. It's supposed to be you've got to control their behaviour so that they get their work done. don't have to do that because it's coming in otherwise. So we're not going to have time to do this, but this interesting guy, have a look on the website, there's a link there, and it's talking about that through gaming we actually, not the games themselves, but gamers, when they design games, build in good learning to them. They offer rewards to success. They don't make them too hard. They take you to the next level, and then they hint at ways of getting further on. They do all the things that good teaching and learning is supposed to do. They just design it within in the program, and the technologies are able to understand you as the user, what you're doing, and adjust to it. And so he's an excellent guy. I'll show you this as an example. Have you seen Mathletics? Have you seen the kids do Mathletics? This is an amazing tool because it's so damn simple. It's not any rocket science, but you know what we talked about. That is the DET or the DEC curriculum. There's nothing sexy about this. It's just the maths curriculum for this year. This is a classic kid, and the things that I really like about it are the goals. It's got the goal bar. You've got to get 9 out of 10 to get a goal bar. The kids won't accept, and I won't accept from the kids anything less than a goal bar. The red and the blue there mean that they've got to do it again, and they don't like getting anything less than the goal, which means mastery, which means they can do it. It's got this. I love this. This kid is virtually been in the centre for 2 days. So they've done 2 hours maths. This is the whole year's work. Now, I'm looking at that bar graph, and I'm looking at about an eighth. So an eighth of a term, that means 5 weeks' work. In 2 hours, this kid has done 5 weeks' work from school of his maths curriculum, not of some Mickey Mouse sort of course that's trying to make him feel good. It's his maths curriculum. You can tell. Look at the topics. Gee, they really excite me. Highest common factor, lowest common multiple. Jeez, the party talk, isn't it? But this is what they've worked through. What's pushed them on is whole heap of feedback, points, certificates. Some kids, I don't play on the certificates and things, but sometimes the kids like to take them with them, the points. And then there's ways the kids can control how they do it. If they find it too hard, they can go for something easier. It doesn't give them a gold bar, but it helps them find out easier examples and then build up to the going back to this where they can get their gold bar. They've got support in terms of, there's a flash that actually shows them how to do it. This is an example. They go to the question mark. Sometimes the flash is helpful, sometimes it's not. But some kids just like to work it out for themselves. And it just runs through a little animation. Nothing too busy. Now, this is all an Australian design that's used around the world, but it's just following those simple principles: direct feedback, simple breaking it down, simple tasks, providing the reporting. Just going to go. We're now online, and this is a classic resource that I would use with the kids. I just want to show you how this is not. This is not big. This is not designing games, or it's just, this is pretty simple. What do you notice about it first? There's a bit of a visual thing, but there's lots of writing. But kids don't mind the writing. But what we do is we break that writing down into shorter paragraphs so the kids can read, and the kids actually read this. I've got it on the whiteboard. They've got it on their computers. So sometimes they read from the whiteboard, sometimes they read from their computer. Most of them read from their computer. They can navigate into this. This is in a learning management system called StudyWiz, which is a bit like Moodle or any of those. But the kids can navigate to there fairly quickly. So we're doing Ned Kelly. And as we go through, I've got the whiteboard that I can go to, and I've got to admit that when I haven't got a whiteboard, I feel really like I keep going and wanting to tap up here. Because the whiteboard, that's what it gives you. It gives you flow. Now, I worked out, you know, kids want to know what Ned Kelly looks like. So, you know, we've got a picture. This is Ned, just before he was hung or hanged. He wasn't that old. Interesting hairstyle there. Maybe if I had a hairstyle like this these days, you'd most only get hanged. So we go through, the kids are reading. We're talking about Ned and his eight brothers and sisters going, living in this hut. We can see the hut, but we move through fairly quickly. How would you fit eight kids in there? This was Ned when he went to jail first time. We talk about the reward that was offered for him, and I can just hit that, and there's £8,000. As soon as I put it up, it's funny, by putting it up, we can talk about it. If I don't put it up and I try to talk about a reward, it doesn't make much sense. Once it's up there, kids sort of get interested about that £8,000 was the equivalent of $2 million. Ned had a $2 million reward on him for 2 years. No one dobbed him in. I say to the kids, your mates, if they $2 million to dob you in, would they dob you in? Oh, no, I got good mates. You can't convince them that no way would that be the case. And we come down and we talk. You know, as we're working through this passage, we see that Ned, when he held up a bank, he used to go and say, look, can someone got a bit of pen and paper? And anyone know how to write? I'm going to give you a bit of a lecture here. And he'd stay in the bank for a couple of hours, and he'd give these people, he'd say, look, take this down. And we've got these records. He sent these letters off. So it's funny. I often read through, or the kids read through it. Or we get Alex to read through it, but he doesn't really sound like Ned Kelly. But if we're going to run out of time here, but this is Ned talking. I wish to acquaint you with some of the occurrences of the past, present, and future. Doesn't sound like a bush ranger, does he? Sounds a bit prim and proper. And if you read that through, but that's actually him dictating to a scribe when he's holding up the bank. And we've got this insight into it. And the kids just seem to be, sometimes I get through that whole page of that letter, sometimes I don't. Doesn't matter. It's just moving it on, giving him something to look at, painting the picture, working, having the options. So we've got all that through there. And then, you know, there's... I usually have a video. I don't know if that will... this will work. Yep. Yeah. And, you know, what they're looking at here is the first motion picture ever made. You know, the first movie ever made. And it's of the story of Ned Kelly. And they found this bit of... And the kids just ask all these questions out of this. But it's all quick. Yeah, well, sometimes they want to know that, and I've got to explain, you know, it's the chemical, the film was highly volatile and broke down when they did it, so that's what you're looking at, and that's why it's really lucky that we've got this last little remnant of it. But it's just because it's not that it's there, it's the speed that it's there. And we're slow here because I haven't got the whiteboard, because the whiteboard gives me the instantaneous click. But you've got to have that design so it's all there. So as I'm designing something like this, you're thinking, what will the kids be interested in? What do we need them to cover? And so... Yep. Yeah, that's all. This is one of the issues around this, is that you won't find these resources out there. It's a bit of a frustration. but you guys can work with the software. As Department of Education employees, you have access to the whole Adobe suite of Photoshop, Dreamweaver, Flash. All that stuff is yours to use for free if you use it at school, and if you want to use it on your computer, it's going to cost you about $100 for a $2,500 software package. Now, if you've got those tools and you know how to use them, this stuff is not rocket science. This is just using Dreamweaver, embedding a few things, and pulling some resources together. It's knowing how to, you know, what you're looking at in terms of doing that that's going to make the difference in making them work. And that's where those 9 principles are really key. Short, doable, feedback, and the flow. Yeah. So I'm running out of time. Yep. No, I will finish there just to say good luck with your the rest of your course and everything. And it's been good talking at you.